which was edited by David Stain. That's how we got there.
Yeah, and, so, and then I just wanted to tell you the anecdote about my correcting of the guy. Yeah, that's just a digress. So back to this, it's really important that to understand McLuhan was, as a public intellectual, as a literate guy, a professor who taught English, what a radical move. He didn't give a fuck about books anymore. He saw something more urgent. What?
Well, I get that, because he said the electric age is an oral age, so...
Well, no, it's a tactile age. The content is oral. The entertainment is oral.
Kind of synonymous in McLuhan? Am I...
No. The earlier tribal eras aren't being recalled. We're not going back to the way we were before books. We're getting into a new thing, which is
correct.
More of an all-at-once.
What's the oral-tactile distinction?
Well, because the new age is tactile. It's not oral. It's not oral.
Yeah, it's tactile. What is tactility? Hey, OJ, what's the definition of tactility? McLuhan's definition, it is not a sense. It's the interplay of the senses, but not a sense. The acoustic is a sense.
Yeah, you're reminding me. I used to know this stuff. Yeah.
So the point is that the way McLuhan talks about tactility is not a sense. That is, in a way, virtual reality. Computers, virtual, you know, Clinton's field. What is this computer stuff? Is it real? Is it electrical? Is it nothingness? It's pretty abstract. And,
yeah, this all started for me when I was asking myself the question, like, I saw a bunch of things happen on the internet, so I wanted to say I was there. But then at the same time, like, wait, where? I was just in my room or on the bus. Where is there? Like, I saw it. I was there. But wait, what the hell does that mean? Right? Like, that was like the overarching question for all of this.
That's right. And so tactility is the interplay. And television is the interplay of all the senses. He said there's even smell in television, because when people look at objects or foods, they smell. You know, so a lot of the senses are involved in black and white TV. So he thought, electricity itself, we don't even know what it is. It's sort of a nothingness. So his term and definition of tactility is very appropriate. I once had a talk with Andrew Crystal. And he told me, he said, McLuhan really made a big mistake, you know, emphasizing tactility or going into this tactile idea. I don't think I agree with Andrew on that point. I think understanding modern art, what Joyce is doing with Finney's Wake, when you have this idea of tactility as the interplay, you might even call it the mind, then a lot of the discontinuous art forms of the 20th century make sense.
Interesting. But didn't he say... The Middle Ages were tactile?
No, they were a balance. He said China had a good balance, the Middle Ages, maybe the Greek period when you have manuscripts, which is the eye, and then the natural tribal oral stuff. It was tactile because all cultures are tactile before the printing press. So it was tactile, but it's odd-out tactile with a balance of the eye. So the medieval thing was a holistic situation. It became unbalanced with the printing press. It emphasized the eye too much. And then the electric age is like the like the Renaissance or like Greek or China. It's a balanced era because the electric tactility balances off the visual legacy of the book. But he said, if we push this tactility through electricity too much, we are gone. So he had a warning about the balance thing. You know, it's like there was an optimism in the 50s and 60s around McLuhan or people in general because it was a balanced situation. But once the digital started coming in, say with the instant replay in the late 60s, early 70s, we were going into a new realm that humans' minds weren't used to. And we became unbalanced. That's why McLuhan had pretty good timing. We should turn off television right now for a while to figure out what's going on. And that was the last time it could be done.
There's a really great quote in the foreword to The Interior Landscape, which I only picked up today. So I only just read it. And McLuhan writes in the foreword, he says, he talks about the cover of TV Guide that has a painting by Salvador Dali on it.
Yes.
And it's two thumbs exhibit two TV screens as thumbnails. That is pure poetry, acute, new perception. Dali immediately presents the fact that TV is a tactile mode of perception. Touch is the space of the interval, not the visual connection. I've been trying to elucidate this fact for years. In vain. The somnambulists know better. Can't he see TV with his eyes? How could it be tactile? Pasteur was thrown out of the medical profession because he insisted doctors wash their hands before surgery. They knew better. They could see that their hands were clean.
Yeah, that is a great, it's a great image. You can see it in Culture's Our Business, the cover of TV Guide, June 1968. And it's pretty incredible. There's these two TV screens that Dali put over thumbnails, but in the background there's a little hazy kind of, it could be considered a little low mountain, and Marcon says, no, that's brain tissue to show that television is an extension of the central nervous system. That's the incredible part. It's an amazing image, and McLuhan's analysis of it is so perfect. And not that Dali meant that, but he did have TV as two things with an interval between them, an extension of the tactile sense of the hand. It's almost literal that Dali was reading McLuhan, you know?
Okay, well, can I ask other questions now?
Yeah.
Okay, I have two more. Please answer briefly if you can.
So what did we get from your first question? You wanted to know if he collaborated. Yes, he collaborated most of his public life.
Yeah. I mean, well, I know. I can see the books where it says by McLuhan and so-and-so, but you showed me that even the ones that don't have that, wasn't this serious authorial stamp. He had students helping him compile quotes and whatever. So that's interesting. That's really good.
Yeah, and so you have to see McLuhan as a person. I experienced this. He said conversation is the greatest art form. He was a talker. He loved talking. He was an incredible talker. All his heroes were great talkers. James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis. He was a talking guy. In a way, he was kind of lazy. I mean, he did do a lot of work in the essays that Clinton just got. Those essays are important. They're really incredible. Oh, that whole book is going to blow your mind. It should, Clinton, The Interior Landscape. So he did a lot of work on that. That's his solo effort. But for some reason, he understood that we're moving into another more casual dimension, and he was starting to relax and allow, you know, by the 50s. I mean, Ted Carpenter talks about he did all the work for the Explorations magazine. He edited it, organized it. McLuhan was a slacker in many ways. Right. He was just always thinking and talking, and that's what he got off on.
Right.
And he was reading a lot. He definitely read a lot, jumped around, skimped. Yeah, I'd see him leaving his office with a pile of 10 books that George went over to St. Mike's, which was just right beside his office, goes over to the library, brings back a pile of books. McLuhan would leave with a pile of fucking books every night. But, you know, he was skimping. He was looking serendipitously for the little fact that would build his case.
Right. I know how that is.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, his work from the 50s, which is like he has some literary work, literary criticism, he has...
No literary criticism. He stops that in 62. This book that Clinton just bought is criticism from 43 to 62. And Peter Montgomery, a knowledgeable student of McLuhan's, said he noticed, as a student of McLuhan in 62, McLuhan had no more interest in literary reviews. He totally dropped it, which was the clue to how much he really was independent of books. Go ahead.
No, I get that. No, here's what I'm saying. So, yeah, he wrote a lot of... literary criticism before that era in the 50s. I've read Interior Landscape, but I'm wondering, someone living in the mid-60s, like 65, would they have, just a lay person, would they have access to, say, Catholic humanism or the Interior Landscape essays? How would they get their hands on that if they're alive?
Wouldn't know about it. And here's what happened. When Gerald Stern's Hot and Cool came out in 67, he had a bit of a big bibliography in the back, which Mark Stewart put together with the help of Richard Dreiberg out in Vancouver, who was an eccentric student of McLuhan. He started really organizing stuff, and I think they used his notes, Stern did in 67. So you had to be a student at St. Mike's, and talk to some professor, say, hey, do you know what Marshall wrote about, where he wrote? And they go, oh, well, he wrote in Renaissance or Catholic Journal. You know, you'd have to get someone in the field to tell you where he was.
Totally. Okay, so, yeah, if you weren't connected to that crowd and you were just living, you were alive in 1965, essentially all you'd have access to for McLuhan would be Mechanical Bride, Gutenberg Galaxy, and Understanding Media, right?
And maybe you might hear about the Explorations.
Oh, Explorations, the journal. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, people in the 50s who were around Toronto, they read it, they bought it, they would know, like people like Robert Fulford. But, yeah, a young student, if it was you, 22 years old, 65, lots of luck.
Yeah.
I don't know what you – and you weren't a student. If you were a student, maybe – you could get particular and ask them. But usually students were just sitting there stunned. They didn't say anything. They didn't know what he was talking about. They really were intimidated.
Right, right. Huh. Okay. Can I ask
And if you did a PhD, McLuhan would tell you, don't do a PhD on me. You'll be failed. Like it was that bad.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay, I have another question that's unrelated. Is it okay?
Yep.
Yeah, so, again, this is for a project I'm doing, but, so this is something you said, which I think you probably got from McLuhan, or if not him, you probably got it from a different media ecologist, or you came up with it yourself. So I'm trying to track down the source on this, Bob. In some of your writings, you talk about how, and I don't need you to explain the quote, I get it, I just, want to know where it's from. So you explain how people before language, they had the stars in their eyes, or it was before some technology, they had the stars in their eyes, and then after that transformation, then they become like us, where, you know, we see the stars as obviously somewhere else, right?
We're no longer the viewers of the screen. We're not enmeshed in the objects that we see.
Yeah.
And that
so
stars in the eyes, that's me. That's my own statement I came up with in the 70s. It might have been influenced by Beefheart, who said around 1970, maybe some Trump Mass Rebel, he said,
right on.
The stars are matter, we are matter, but it don't matter. The stars are matter.
You know what, Bob? I think I've asked you this before. I've asked you this before, and you gave me the same answer I think I'm remembering now. But
I'm consistent.
I just can't believe it, because it's basically that kind of idea really shows up in this piece of art I'm analyzing, which I don't want to talk about. And that person was heavy, heavy, heavy into McLuhan. I know that. So, it just seems like quite a coincidence that this thing that you said fits so well. You know, this kind of evolutionary leap we go through where we are totally connected to the outside world, and then we kind of get cut off a little bit, and it gives us this kind of autonomy. That's a very McLuhan-y kind of thing, right? The senses shifting and changing social dynamics or how we live. So, all right, but if you don't have anything on that, I'll just...
Yeah, no, that's for me. He didn't do it, but he understanding him, you could come up with that if you understand him. Astronomy, you know, the Aztecs and Mayans, that's early looking at the sky, is the beginning of visual space. And McLuhan says that the pyramids are on the border between tactile cultures and the beginning of visual space. So you have big mountains of rock was the way tactile people conceptualized the eye world. Very interesting point. The eye world has to be shown, this weird new experience they're having, which would be start with from early writing systems. They were intimidated by it, so they saw it as a big, big rock. Okay.
Wow, wait, what are you citing here?
It's McLuhan. He does say that one place, the big sculpting of space. The tactile is sculpture. When you sculpt something, as you move into the new strange world of the eye, you sculpt a big thing. I don't know how he came up with that, but that's what he said.
Where did he? Okay, you don't know where, but you don't know where that's written, or
no? Because here's the thing. You have to, like what Clinton's doing, reading those criticisms. You got to go back and read every article, because every article has one little point that's important to understand McLuhan in it. He, like, consciously put a little jewel in each article. Often the articles had repeating themes, but you look for the little jewel, and you go, oh, okay, there's another piece of the puzzle, you know? Because when I read that thing about the pyramids, that was pretty interesting for me to think about. No one else had read it. No one else knew it. I would think about it. You know, in a new way, a different way.
I'll be honest. I like everyone else, I struggle with these McLuhanisms. But that's very interesting.
You will find a key little fact, like this thing about the transition from the tactile culture to the beginning of visuality in astronomy. And maybe astrology later, but anyways, astronomy, measuring the sky, and I've got a lot of audio from Ion describing how the Incas and Mayans did it, and that's interesting to add to the McLuhan. But to understand this tactile transition to the visual is really important.
Huh. Yeah. Well, Bob, I have another question, but if you want to get to someone else, I can ask next week.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, it's an interesting question. So, can you talk about the nature of figure and ground? That's obviously very important for Yorui McLuhan's work. It comes from Gestalt psychology. Is that correct?
Oh yeah. Hell, I can handle this one. I mean,
well, I'd rather hear Bob. No offense, but yeah.
Well,
no, I have something that Clinton's not going to know.
Okay.
So let's hear Clinton give the standard party line, then I'll have something to add.
All right, well, sure. Well, consciousness. What's going on is that your consciousness is figuring some part of your inner landscape, which corresponds to the outer world. And so whatever it is that you are capable of looking at or sensing or having thoughts about or paying attention towards is going to be in direct contrast to all the things that you can't, do not, and will not ever actually pay attention to, which consists of your subconscious, which is the ground, which is massaged by all the things you're not paying attention to. And so you're pulling fragments out of the ground, and that becomes the next thought that you have, and you're pushing new conscious things back down into the subconscious. And so that's just his way of modeling consciousness in the entire figure of your entire potential mind as it corresponds to the outside, and the entire potential, all the meaning you could possibly be making in an analogical way out of all the things being presented to your senses by the outside. And so everything else just proceeds logically from there.
All right. I like that thing. Yeah. Bob, I'm sure you have a lot more to say.
Yeah.
I got something to add. I actually just typed this on some forum just the other day, point out no one else has ever mentioned this. In the Explorations magazine number 8, which became a book of its own in 67. It came out in 57. It's called Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations. There's like 24 items, neat little items that McLuhan develops. And apparently he did that all by himself. But anyways, there's an item. I don't know which one it is. You have to find it. And I'd have to look at the book. He's talking about the beginnings of novels after the printing press and how a common theme was you take a character, so the individual becomes a figure. And remember, it's all collective epic stuff before the printing press. Now you're going to have individuals and individual psychology. So these novelists would place the individual in a background. Remember, in their medicine, they had the four humors. You know, people were made up of four types of whatever the humors were, and that was your ground. So they would present an individual type over a humor. Now, that's a figure over a ground. So a singular figure over a ground is visual biased. When McLuhan talks about figure ground, he's retrieving book sensibility, printing press bias, to wake up a left hemisphere as an anti-environment to the electric age. When you have the actual figure ground process that Clinton was talking about involves more than one figure ground. You have several figure grounds. and the interplay of them. That's what real figure ground awareness is that McLuhan is asking you to do. But because you are illiterate and he wants to prop up books, have something for people to read, he takes a visual bias, figure ground, and shows that Bob Dylan is a product of television, or Elvis is a figure for a ground. Now, nobody knows this. That's a visual bias way of looking at things. Tribal people don't see a figure over a ground. They don't separate figures from the ground. That's why they don't have any idea of nature. They're just involved in it. The eyes are in their stars. And we don't even know if they see the stars or how they see them. But once you have literacy, you start to isolate a figure over a background. What do you think of that, Clinton? You've never heard that before.
It sort of jives with the idea that it's typographical man who is the one that has an unconscious or a subconscious. The subconscious is created by the heightening of the visual bias, right? But yeah, the multiple figures and grounds, I guess they all have to, you know, resonate somehow in tactility, right? Like, this sounds like we're getting into the mechanics of tetrads or something.
Yeah. So when you have figure ground, that's the visual bias. We walk around, we see someone coming out of a background. I mean, that's perspective. But in actuality, in the electric age and before the visual age, people had many. They didn't have figure grounds. They had a lot of interplay of sensory ratios. They had great sensitivity to proprioceptive balance, all that incredible stuff that preliterate people can do with their bodies. That is due to a great sensitivity to the interplay of whatever they thought their bodies were made up of. Because they didn't think in terms of senses. We don't know how they image themselves.
So I'd like to just probe what you said. If I'm listening to a song and I pay attention to the bass line as figure, does the rest of the music come ground, and does that make it a visual thing I'm doing with the sound? Or if I'm listening to one thing in a crowded room full of people,
a visual, because remember, what's really going on is the room and the environment the music is being heard in. There's a big part of the ground. Or you may not be in a room. You may be out in the fields and the prairies with the Indians, you know, and trying to bring up, evoke new rain or the buffalo.
Okay,
it's an environmental process.
In that case, the most popular contemporary feeling which retrieves that tribal state, which is not contained in the visual space paradigm, would be this highly superstitious, paranoid state of everything around you, you know, having meaning or being there for a reason,
yep.
Or, you know, and a cat crosses your path and you walk under a ladder and all that stuff, and just feeling the raw preconscious sense of the whole world resonating stuff at you. Like, that would be the non-visual experience today.
Yeah,
right?
That's a tactile culture. And McLuhan used to say tribal cultures were paranoid. They thought everything was connected to everything. Now, let me show you a neat subtlety. When you start getting into visual space after the Roman Empire and you get into the Middle Ages, what was the main way of thinking in the medieval period? Everything was every object, anything you noticed was a symbol, a sign of some significance. So they had visualized what the tribal paranoia was. They put it in kind of visual order because they were writing and they had manuscripts. But so we call it symbolism. Symbolism is a great, you know, product of the eye. Symbols are like figure grounds. You have a symbol and it represents something else. So
okay,
there's
but
interplay
it,
there.
But it's still trying to order or visualize vibrant sensory experience of the oral, I guess, dark.
Try to put in visual order. I mean, you know, we look at visual order as kind of people trying to make systems of thought, and it all fails over in the long run. And we say, what a bunch of foolishness. You have to realize people, it was a novelty. It was exciting to visually put it into order. You know, they got seduced by it. Just like our time, it's exciting to be audio tactile and be a musician, right? Musicians had no appeal back in the medieval period in terms of a novel experience. Visuality did. So that's why these guys wrote all these books and manuscripts and obsessed over putting things into visual order. It was a novelty.
Holy crap, I can hold
it. Before.
Look, I can hold a big boring train of thought. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Aren't I impressive? All the chicks, like, you know, fall to their knees, rip their pants off. Oh, my God. This guy was boring for 25 minutes straight. He didn't even take a breath or notice my tits. Oh, my
God. Clinton, that's a little biased. They were monks. They were all they were homosexuals.
Oh, of course, of course.
They could get the next guy's pants off. So it's really interesting to recover, to put yourself back there and realize, see, it's natural for us to be bored with visual order, but to put yourself back there, that it was exciting, you know, to put things in visual order. That's why humans did it for so long. Read the history of math. Holy shit, are those guys nuts. All the mathematicians, especially since Descartes, the craziness they made in their formulas, a lot of abstraction, crazy relationships, triviality, it seems, you know? If A is to B, when X is 3, well, you make X is 4, the A is not to B. Try to entertain your friends with that one. Try to spring math on anybody today.
Well, I'm sure they would just build a bridge and impress everybody, right? That's what they were really up to. All right. Hey, if I can search my ebook of Verbi Voco Visual here, what would I search for, you think, to find what you were talking about there with the figure ground?
Look for, it's say about the middle, say around 12 or 13, you're looking for the description of novels and writings in the 1600s, 1700s. So, you know, it's not the one on wine, it's not the one on this, not Big Brothers. Just look for a title that, just start saying a few titles to me in the middle of the book.
It's an e-book here. That's not that long a book.
Oh, you got an e-book.
Yeah, third program in the human age. The semantics money uses. Okay, I'll go back earlier. Eminent extrapolators. The old
that
rich and the new rich. Eminent extrapolators?
I'm going to go get my copy and speed this up. Just a second.
The scholastic philosophy ended very soon after print appeared. Let's see. Scholastic was an oral technique for processing and commenting on patristic and other written texts. That is why it is becoming popular again today. The new criticism is not improperly labeled scholastic insofar as it's a technique of commenting on printed text modeled by the flexibility of classroom discussion. Scholasticism was a means of digesting every kind of text and seeing it swiftly from many points of view. Print had no such use for diversity or simultaneity. Prints preferred to pursue one line, one level at a time. Yeah, this might be it. I know that I don't see it being explicit about figure ground, though.
What number is that one? Is that extrapolators?
Yeah, it's on it's number 22.
Okay, so I got my book here. I'm going to go back at 12:14, see what comes up here. This is a really good book. Organization Man is 15. Here's a good line. Compared to big business, academic and literary worlds often seem like a jungle because big business was becoming electric and corporate and becoming crudely media-ecological. The individualism anarchism was in the academic and literary world, even though the literary guys thought that the businessmen were corrupt. Here's another line. Not Big Brother is watching, but all the brothers. See, he tended to point out, he had a sense of more going on than your average perspective. Your average perspective is very narrow. You think it's singular figure ground. He knew there was all kinds of operations. He talked about mini-states. There were national print states, but there were many mini-states caused by electric decentralization. He said the music industry was a mini-state. He saw more complexity than people did.
Right, that's why managers in Take Today could be more than just literal managers. They were just literally anybody in, I guess, a mini-state.
Right. Okay, so look, it's number 16.
Vertical entities.
Now remember, horizontal symbolism is non-visual. It's acoustic collage. Vertical symbolism is visual space. So vertical entity. So he says at the top, after Madame Bovary, which is Flaubert, 19th century, character becomes theme again in art structures. In all serious writing thereafter, characters cease to be vertical entities in a social milieu. See, vertical entities in a social milieu is figure ground in the printing phase. But when you get into the telegraph phase, you get Flaubert, and character becomes theme in art structures. That's how McLuhan in Mechanical Bride makes ads and comics characters in a new kind of science fiction he said he created. All right? So, in 16 says, in Chaucer, the realism never detracts from the polyphony of character themes. So this is before the figure ground. Detracts from the polyphony of character themes or contrapuntal melodies, all simultaneously heard. There's a good statement describing mixed corporate tactile interplay, right? Contrapuntal melodies, all simultaneously heard. Until about 1600, in art, literature, and music, the only way of organizing a structure was the song technique of superimposed or parallel themes and melodies. That's why I use the term paramedia rather than just media ecology. Paramedia. When the Romantics say that, quote, Shakespeare draws his characters in the round, unquote, they're using their own flat, painterly language to describe the Shakespearean music. All of Shakespeare exists in auditory depth. He evokes and defines his world in auditory space. The complexity of any of his characters is enforced by all the others being simultaneously present. So it's an ecology. Music has the power of instantly imposing its own assumptions. So persistent is this auditory mode in Shakespeare that he has none of the pictorial habit of Ben Jonson or Beaumont or Fletcher in displaying character against local background. He had no fashionable sophistication. See, he was new to place a character against the ground. He had no upper-class patina. The sudden shift to painting people in their humors, and that's italicized, or is dominated by a ruling passion, a ground, Don Quixote, for example, corresponds to the sudden discovery of harmonics and musical narrative. It corresponds to Montaigne's minute portraiture of his reactions to books or to Poussin's or Bruegel's sudden placing of figures in a landscape and not in front of it. They're inside. The landscape could now function pictorially as humor or ruling passion in narrative, drama, or essay. And that's important. Media are ruling passions or humors, if you want to bring in the medieval sensibility. The landscape could now function pictorially as humor or ruling passion in narrative, drama, or essay. The contrapuntal stacking of themes once more in an auditory song structure was back in all the arts by 1900. Joyce's chamber music is strategic in selecting the vocal art of 1600 as a prism through which to refract all the new motifs of 1900. Then the next page, chronological linear narrative against a social background had ended, you know, once you get into the 20th century. The very background of Proust's Paris or Joyce's Dublin had become a theme and character themselves. See, the medium becomes a character. This is really important, you know, to get this. I mean, I didn't get this for years. And, I don't know, back there in the 80s or some point, I reread this and said, holy shit, this is figure ground. That's visual bias. Fuck, nobody ever knew that. Are you getting what I'm saying? Can you see what I'm saying, Clinton?
Yeah, I'm reading along. I think I see what you're saying.
Okay, let me read the rest.
Go for it.
Yeah, but between 1600 and 1900, the Gutenberg galaxy, the landscape had been used to define and isolate passions. Then with Baudelaire, Rimbaud, and Laforgue, they were the new acoustic telegraph symbolists, the interior landscape had been used to control the audience emotions directly as later in advertising. This has been T.S. Eliot's forte. It is not strange that the public should be confused by a revolution in art and technique which matches the changes in physics so exactly. Look at that, the ground changing arts and science. But it is a change easily intelligible in the light of the drive of the past century towards the dominance of the auditory and the oral as a ruling dynamic in Western experience. So there he's applying a figure ground pattern right there. The auditory is retrieved in the electric environment. That's a figure ground. That's a useful way of looking at things for a literate person. Because otherwise, you go back to the first sentence where you got characters or themes or contrapuntal melodies all simultaneously heard. Or the complexity of any of his characters is enforced by all the others being simultaneously present. That's the way Finnegan's Wake is written. Okay, so then to control these developments by solemn gesture of the abdominal hand, that's the hand that you sort of, you put your hand up and ask people to quiet down or to be peaceful. That's the abdominal hand, okay? The solemn gesture. To control these developments by solemn gesture of the abdominal hand is our current strategy. What an amazing statement. Real control comes by study of the grammars of all the media at once. So there's something limiting by the all those congressmen and all those senators putting their abdominal hand up against Trump and telling him to calm down, have some fucking diplomatic sensitivities, right? And yet Trump is quadriphenic ecology. You're not going to be subject to the solemn gesture of the abdominal hand. It says, the breakdown of contrapuntal pattern, that means the acoustic writing, the breakdown of contrapuntal pattern in the later 16th century was related to the high development of printed music. Before print, musical notation served many functions, but it made no attempt to give detailed instructions to a variety of voices or instruments. And just as detailed instructions brought improvisation to an end, so in literary art there's a rapid withdrawal from contrapuntal organization. Finnegan's Wake retrieves all that, contrapuntal organization. All those aspects of recurrent Elizabethan imagery and double plots, which have been such exciting discoveries for the 20th century, were for long the normal song and music components of verbal composition. All right, so it had to be rediscovered, the pre-printing phrase scene. Let's see. With the change to harmonic vertical structure, well, the problem was how to narrate. That was the Gutenberg phase. A century of essays ensued before the simple idea of the novel took over. It took them a fucking 100 years to figure out how to do a narrative. Thereafter, characters held in a single passion or humor, figure ground, could be set on a lineal road of adventure. Isn't that amazing?
Wow, yeah, it's also nested, all of the media, and where media is people, media is landscape, media is just the various depths of, so like all of the Shakespeare characters were really deep, and they had to like spill their guts out one at a time at each other.
They were a band. They were like a Zappa band.
Yeah, for lack of having a common ground of setting that, you know, was relatable, right?
Right. They weren't imprisoned in a single humor or passion that visual space brought in. That's why McLuhan says humans become robots when the printing press comes in. They get isolated. Didn't we see that? The landscapes now function pictorially as humor. That wasn't the sentence. There's one where he talks about isolation. Chronological linear narrative against a social background that ended. All right, so. The sudden shift to painting, people in their humors, and that's italicized, that's important, in their ground, or is dominated. There's no domination in acoustic tactile structures. It's a musical interplay. Now you get dominated, corresponds to the sudden discovery of harmonics in musical narrative. The landscape can now function. Yeah.
So once the characters become dominated by a ruling passion, I guess they become like one-dimensional. But then, but now they're figures in a landscape, and the landscape could now function pictorially as humor or a ruling passion in narrative. So we get this quote here.
You know what that does? That starts to isolate causes from effects. You get into Newtonian science looking for the sequential or efficient causality of things, because in the preliminary society, the effects and the causes are intertwined. But when you start separating, looking for the cause as it affects, bounces against something else through connected space, visual space, the interplay of cause and effects is biased visual science. That's why McLuhan said he was a scientist. He was a new kind of scientist. He was looking at environments. He wasn't limited to visual space science.
Right. When everyone lacks the ability to even account for their own actions, or, you know, because they're so robotic in their thinking, right? Right. That's when you can discover that there's a subconscious, or you can discover that there's superstitious forces making people do things or whatever, some sort of externalized loci of control, right?
That's right. The whole idea of the subconscious was the invention of the printing press. And, of course, when you move into the electric age, therefore we become aware of the subconscious, and you get Freudianism.
Well, I mean, that's also
obsolete.
That's also the hidden puppet master conspiracy theorist who is it that's making all these people think this thing? What's the hidden source of what's making all these people, there needs to be some sort of locus of control, right? Because clearly these people aren't accountable for their own thoughts, right? Whatever it is.
Yes, you have, with the printing press, then McLuhan even has it in Gutenberg Galaxy. One of the titles is, people could start to conspire. They had a context with printing press to have puppetry, and so people thought they were being conspired against, and they thought there was a banking conspiracy. So the Illuminati and this idea, the Alex Jones world of a group, a cabal manipulating everybody, that's only possible under print conditions.
Right. Everyone else would be far too space. There'd be no possibility for vertical dimension.
No homogeneity. No being on the same page to control it. You know, you had to get to the top of the page, be the title, you were the great manipulator. If you were the title of the page.
Huh.
So what do you say to that? Let's see what OJ says. What do you think, OJ?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he talks about Freud in one of his letters to Vogelin about secret societies, and he talks about how, you know, the human sciences like anthropology and psychology are like the battleground for these two cults. And the Freud is like the more, I think the Western Neoplatonist, and Jung is Gnostic Eastern. But you know, it's interesting that we've gotten here because I wanted to just point out. I think those letters are misleading. I don't think he actually believed in substantive secret societies. I think he was really just talking about how looked at from a different perspective. A lot of the behavior of people in society, whether they're, you know, top academics or whatever, is very much modeled after these cults, especially in what they actually believe. Their beliefs are very much reminiscent of these Gnostic cults, you know. So for example, when he says, oh, my God, I just realized I had no idea that in order to get somewhere and be successful as an artist or an intellectual, you have to be a part of these cults. He says that, right? Which makes all your conspiracy theory instincts go wild, right? But I don't think he actually means he had to be inducted in some secret room to be in some society. I think he just means you have to model your intellectual work has to fit a certain pattern, right? This kind of
okay, but wait a minute. Let me correct some of that. This conspiring, and he has it right there, comes into the printing press, is rampant through the Gutenberg Galaxy, you know, for 300 or 400 years. He told me that he was constantly being approached by secret societies that wanted him to join them. And he didn't want to be part of that. He didn't believe in a monopoly of knowledge. So visual space, the Gutenberg arts, music, sculpture, painting, and novels and stuff, and poetry, that's visual space that can be conspired in. And that's the whole elite thing. I was reading something in the history of mathematics, all the great geniuses. They were all kept out by the control at the universities. You could control the scene. So it was human control, trying to keep everything visually ordered. That was the conspiracy. But it all fell apart in the electric age.
Right, but you're saying that there actually were some secret societies trying to recruit him. Were these elite secret societies, or were these some weirdos?
Yeah, local. He never said who they were, but they were... different groups, and they would be spin-offs of the Shriners and there's the Catholic groups. I forget the Knights of Columbus, Knights of Malta. The Protestants were Freemasons. These were normal community things in America. They're like the Kiwanis, a Rotary. They would help the community. But if you remember, you got extra help. You know, your family. If you died, your family would be helped. So it was just normal way of organizing a hierarchical, visually biased, fragmented society. You don't have secret societies in tribal cultures. You got fucking gangs, and they're not hiding. They're out there attacking you blatantly. You know, they're taking, and then they throw the kid. It was no big deal to initiate a kid. How do you initiate a kid? You throw him out in the wilderness, and he had to fend for himself, and he'd have his vision. You know, that was common in a lot of acoustic places. You had to figure out yourself before you were an adult, so to speak.
Okay. There's a article McLuhan wrote for Commonweal magazine. It's called "The God Making Machines of the Modern World," and so
very good article.
There's excerpts to that. You've read it?
Oh yeah, I know it well. I quote it. I was talking about it the other day. Maybe it was Saturday. The phrase the cranial wall plugs.
Oh yeah, yeah, I remember. Is that
in the God Making Machines of the Modern World?
Yeah. It's about subliminal seduction. No, wait a minute. No. I might be getting... There's an article in 57 on the God Making. That's about Ferdinand Lundberg and the... not Lundberg,
yeah.
But the social
John Lundberg, yeah. Yeah, that's why I mentioned this, because it seems
now,
like...
Now, is cranial wall plugs in that article?
I don't have the full thing. I've got the excerpts from Cameron McEwen here. I haven't seen the entire article.
There's another article at the same time called Subliminal Seduction on Project or Subliminal Projection on Project. It's like, here's a projection of my own project, was like implied in one of the meanings of the title. Those two articles are important, both done in 57. And one has a cranial wall plugs and... The writer, Foundations of Social Survival, McLuhan was saying these non-Christian oligarchs are going to take over the global village after World War II and create a norm-functioning society, not a moralistic, mythic imposition on people.
Yeah.
You could say, yeah, that's in that one, in the one you've got, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I mention this just because it seems to line up with the sort of thing that McLuhan's worries about Gnostic, cults and whatnot.
Yeah.
Seems to line up exactly with his concerns in this one about Lindbergh and the UN.
Why don't you read some of it? It's a really good article. Like, just take the middle part where he's talking about the difference between myth and norm functioning.
Yes, Karl Marx. Hold on. Here. So, it is to tracing the social and political consequences of the fall, which I suppose is the fall from grace, fall into, like, the fall of mankind from the perfect Garden of Eden, union of perfectness that was, you know, we fell into sin when we invented logic after eating the fruit of rationality, right? I think that's the Gnostic myth he's talking about. It is tracing the social and political consequences of the fall that Lindbergh devotes much of this book. Paradoxically, the fall brings about the rise of individual reason and the invention of the instruments of culture and civilization. Reason, the tool-making faculty, is the fruit of evil, and reason is the myth-making power which produces the ruler. The ruler rules by the myth or lie which intimidates men to the point of social obedience. It is important to grasp Lindbergh's idea of myths and norms, since they have characterized all civilization till now, but henceforth they must have new functions. Myths are, for Lindbergh, the traditional religions imposed on men. They are products of reason. They are expedient lies. They are the means of curbing the monsters bred of men's passions. Norms, or moral conventions, on the other hand, are merely a cinematic projection on the screen of the city as passions and preferences of men. Myths are vertical affairs imposed by ruling authority on the ruled. Norms are horizontal developments spreading outwards in accordance with men's desires. Myths are static. The authoritarian myth-built city is local, brittle, easily susceptible to shock. If one myth falls, all will tend to fall. But the norm-structured society is open, elastic, malleable, receptive of change. Under conditions of communication, under current conditions of communication, the static myth-built cities of the Western world are doomed, says Lindbergh. The foundations of social survival are, however, to be found in a switch from reason to passion, from fear to love. And the possibility of the switchover resides in our capacity today to discover the creative dynamics of norm-making. Norm, the region of passion and flux, was no basis for any past city, but norm, seen as a product of an individual and collective creative activity, may be a clue to a new social dynamics. If we can discover by observation of many societies, past and present, the principles of creativity in morals, we shall have the master clue to all future governments of huge intercultural associations of men. And then he goes on to say that Lindbergh says we should look to the idea of Christian charity in a spirit of positivism to inform our new horizontal race.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, McLuhan was suspicious of the non-Christians putting on Christian love right. in the way you just read as a way of managing society for not friendly forces. Now, that's a good description of tetrad management, norm functioning, flexible. And you'll see that in my diary. You know, I was told in Secret Council 10, we let everybody run around and do what they want to do. We maintain control of the medium. And the medium is electric. It keeps us in charge because it keeps the humans all distracted as they try to keep up with the Joneses and find out what the latest norms or trends are.
Well, see, the word that comes to my mind is role model, right? Everyone has to be a good role model, right? You need as many celebrities as possible to all be acting in accordance to the way that trickles downhill, well, in whatever small verticality you can manage with centralized media. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got many types of people, you know, in touch with each other through electric media, so you need all kinds of role models for the different astrological types. And that's Time Magazine. Time Magazine does an inventory of all the media institutions of society every week and tells you the role models, the new trends in each part of society. You know, you ever look at the inventory of Time Magazine, the departments?
Oh, hell, I've sold Time Magazine for 5 years. I don't think I ever fucking picked it up.
Anyways, as McLuhan said, you can't tell the truth in time style. The truth might be aligned to a myth or an imposed lie or social fact that the society agrees on. You can't tell truth in time style because time is horizontal. It's managing a whole orchestra of passions. So you see in that article, McLuhan comes the closest to showing his secret society divisions, the vertical versus the horizontal. The norm world is the horizontal, and the myth world, the old world, is vertical. It was not published, but there's McLuhan's essay that I included in my essay on McLuhan back 20 years ago. He says what the role of the secret societies, the Manichaean Gnostic societies, they either favor the vertical, which is moral discipline in the West, or the Gnostic collage of the horizontal thing.
This is pretty amazing, because what I'm immediately thinking now is the internet that I grew up on, where there were so many different web forums, and all of them had rules that were agreed on by the communities, and, you know, they were top-down enforced by the moderators, and everyone had to obey the rules. But now you have social media going crazy because corporations have all these double standards and won't even enforce their own rules properly, and everyone is scared. Everyone is scared of the mythic imposition by, you know, like, oh, these guys will just attack me and mob me and get away with it impetuously because everyone has to go along with what they do and follow that, right? They're all role models, right? All the trolls are role models for how to go attack people and get their way with impunity. And everyone's scared and has to do what they say. That's a horizontal. Like, there is a battle between the actual top, the vertical, rule-based, proper decorum, self-control, literate, typographical internet versus the, you know, the people nobody wants to piss off and just go along with whatever they say, no matter how inconsistent it is, right? But they're fully
right.
Fledged.
So they rule by the unknown, by anxiety, by nobody's really following the rules.
Yes, but they got the passions down completely. They've governed by passions, right? You don't want to piss off the people who can get you fired from your job when 27 people call your boss and get you kicked out or whatever the hell, right?
Yeah. And you don't even know what's going to irritate your boss, like that guy at Facebook. He just put a memo among the people, hey, maybe we should look at this male-female thing a little differently. He was kicked out. He didn't expect that was violent. He didn't know the rules. Nobody knew the rules.
He was an autist. He was just responding to the question, right? They asked for feedback. They asked for feedback, and he gave his autistic feedback. And he got pummeled by everyone. Yeah.
Because nobody knows so you fill in conspiracy Alex Jones stuff to fill in the sense that there is somebody who knows what they're doing and you got to be afraid of them. There are all kinds of gangs that you got to be afraid of, but the thing is nobody's in charge anymore. The only thing in charge is the Android meme saying what the news is today, the word that makes the market. That's what's in charge, and everybody has to react to it. But when you come to your chemical body and how you're doing, you don't have a clue what the rules are, but you better assume there are rules. And so nobody does anything. They're not even decent anymore. They don't care about what's happening to other people. They just stick in their little cubicle and grind the axe of their stupid little job.
Keep your head down.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, I opened it up for Brent and Lorne. You guys are welcome to contribute.
Yay! The meme makes the market, Bob. The meme makes the market.
And you're making good comments there whenever you post stuff. Quoting for me, it's very good, Brent. Appreciate
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm trying to be mildly irritating online and also informative.
Yeah, as long as you don't mention the mysterious force of Bob Dobbs, say you're okay.
Don't want to be associated with that guy.
Right.
Hey, I'd like to give a shout.
Lauren wants to say something. See if Lauren wants to say something. Maybe he has anything to say.
There's you were talking earlier about the tribal acoustic space and the literary visual culture, and I brought up in my mind this island in Lake Titicaca in Peru, the highest freshwater lake in the world. They have this island, Tequile. I lived there for a week, but what's specific about this island is the men of the island are the knitters, and they start when they're 6 or 7 by knitting a hat that shows all of their status in the culture. There's only 2,000 people that live on this island. But they all the men have these hats that they start sewing when they're a kid that shows their family, what their parents do, what their potentials are, their marital status, blah, 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 blah. And it's all codified in pattern and color and everything like that. And the people who live on the island can read who this person is purely from the hat that they wear. And then as they shift through life, they knit new hats. But first off, there's only 2,000 people on the island, so everybody knows who everybody is already. So it's kind of besides the point to need these hats, but yet it's one of these traditions, and it doesn't seem very acoustic.
Oh, no, it's you look at McLuhan's division of the hemispheres that he gets from the scientists. Abstract pattern is what right hemisphere tribal people see, whereas left hemisphere have abstract visual order. There's two kinds of abstract, and the intricate weaving of pattern with color is the pre-literate society. So you got to know the two kinds of abstraction. It's like what McLuhan said, there's two of everything. Take any theme, there's an acoustic and a visual.
Okay. So right and left hemispheres, south and north, or east and west? No, north in this case.
No, left hemisphere is a pre-industrial society, right hemisphere is pre- or post-industrial.
Okay. Yeah.
So the abstract, you look at a lot of tribal, a lot of art in the medieval period, a lot of intricate weaving, like the Book of Kells, the Irish manuscripts, the monks did. they're really into psychedelic intertwined complexity visually.
Right. But that's preliterate.
Yeah, that's a balanced eye. It's involved with the other contrapuntal interplay of the senses. So it's not simple. Not a simple dialectic.
Yes, Prime Minister Leon.
Excellent.